Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting next with James Wallner, a man that I knew a long time ago when he was one of the senior staff on Capitol Hill. He's gone on to other things, including now as a senior fellow at the R Street Institute and as a lecturer, Department of Political Science at Clemson University. He's a very accomplished Washington insider who has also contributed in, well, the spirit of, I guess, public education as much as anything, with a new and very content-rich site entitled legislativeprocedure.com. Think of it as sort of an advanced course in civics, which all of us need. James, it's great to have you with us. Welcome. Happy New Year to you, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. Happy New Year to you. And look, I don't think it was that long ago. You're making me feel quite old. I used to sit across the table from you in meetings and on Capitol Hill. So
it seems like a lifetime ago, but
it does seem like a lifetime ago.
Anyway, it's good to reconnect with you. So what caught my eye was a piece that you wrote recently at The Great Anchor that was, I think, a corrective on some of the romanticizing that has been going on in the wake of the death of former majority leader and Democratic leader, Harry Reid. Your truth-telling was, I think, very welcome. Remind us about Harry Reid, how he operated, and his mark on the Senate, which, I think continues to be felt today.
Well, Harry Reid is someone who I've spent a long time observing. My professional career in the Senate pretty much spanned the Reid's years as majority leader, a little bit as minority leader as well. But it was a time where I saw up close what Reid did to the Senate. And this piece I wrote after his death at the end of last year, I wrote it. It first appeared in Reason, and then I reposted it on my site, The Great Anchor. But it's to try to take a step back and to assess Reid as a leader, not necessarily as someone whom, for policy purposes or other things, and I don't agree with Harry Reid on policy, and I don't agree with what Harry Reid did to the Senate, but I wanted to try to get a sense of what he did as a leader and how that impacted the Senate to this day. And I think it was quite significant, and I said so in the piece.
And not to the good, I think it's fair to say. Describe the ways in which he impacted the Senate negatively, as you see it.
So Reid did something that I think most leaders don't do. In fact, all leaders that I've studied or I've observed up close have never done, which is he changed how he led the Senate. He changed how he operated and behaved in response to events. And in doing so, he shut down the floor. So when Reid takes over as Democratic leader, you have an influx of liberal Democrats into the already liberal Democratic caucus that creates a challenge for Reid. You have a bunch of conservatives come to the Senate, people like Mike Lee and Pat Toomey, and they're joining people that are already there like Jim DeMint. And they want to disrupt, just like the liberals, the status quo. They want to force votes on things. And so what Reid does, and cooperation with Mitch McConnell, incidentally, is that he shuts down the Senate floor. He shuts it down completely in a way that senators 20, 30, 40 years ago, much less 100 years ago, would have been aghast at. And he basically creates a process whereby he forces senators to choose between bills and their rights as senators to offer amendments. And more times than not, he was able to pass legislation, not all good legislation, but legislation with zero deliberation inside the Senate.
Wow. And why that's so important, of course, is that from its inception under the Constitution, the Senate was deemed to be a deliberative body. Indeed, it was called internationally the world's greatest deliberative body. So when you talk about shutting down the Senate, James Wallner, you're talking about mutating the character of the institution really beyond recognition, and in a way that rendered it incapable, would you say, of performing that vital task of really thinking through and debating rigorously and, well, serving as, I guess it was said by the founders, to serve as sort of a cooling saucer for an often overheated teacup that the House of Representatives represents.
Sure. I would say unwilling, not unable, because I think the senators, ultimately, they can do whatever they want. And what made Reed so skillful was that he would set up a process whereby senators felt compelled to go along with him. The Senate has two jobs. That's to pass legislation and to adjudicate the concerns of the American people and to deliberate. And those, neither one's more important than the other. But the Senate actually has a third job, if you think about it, or those two jobs are done to a third end, and that is to check the House. We have bicameralism. The only purpose of bicameralism is to divide the legislative power so that it doesn't become too powerful and the majority doesn't rule. To check the House, it has to operate differently than the House. It can't operate in the same way, be accountable to the same people, and impacted by the same events. Then it would not serve as much of a check. And throughout its history, the Senate has operated differently than the House. Increasingly, what you're seeing is the Senate operating just like the House. And in so doing, it becomes not a check, but a rubber stamp. And at that point, it's like, well, why do we have it? Right? I mean, it's kind of expensive to have two chambers. What's the point of two chambers if you don't have one that operates differently and deliberates and debates and brings in all the views of other people and has a process whereby losers in debates are reconciled to the outcomes? And maybe the winners realize they weren't all smart at the beginning and they learned something else along the way, and the American people get to weigh in. And in the end, hopefully, we get what Madison calls in Federalist 51, a system that points us in the direction of justice and the general good. Because when we do all agree, that's ultimately what we can agree on.
James, the logical endpoint of the kinds of changes that you've talked about and their effect, specifically reducing the character and value of the Senate, is the end of the filibuster. And there is now, as you know, a concerted effort underway. The President of the United States specifically endorsed the idea yesterday in Georgia. And I want to talk to you in a minute about the rest of his speech. But just on this point, Chuck Schumer now seems to be bent on ending the filibuster and doing so in order to pass these voting rights acts, as they're called. What would the effect be on what's left of the unique character and vital role of the Senate were that to happen?
I think it could be quite extraordinary. And to help your listeners understand, I think it's helpful to look at this from a slightly different perspective. The debate right now inside the Senate over its rules is not about minorities filibustering legislation, because we haven't had any filibusters, in my opinion. We've had two cloture votes on October 18th and November 3rd or 4th? On two bills. That's it.
And cloture, again, is the cessation of filibusters by the necessary majority.
Correct. So when the Senate debates a bill, it has to first decide that it wants to debate that bill. This seems a little silly to people, but if you think about it, you're sitting around your kitchen table, you're trying to prioritize, you have your spouse, and you're trying to say, well, what should we have for dinner tonight? Or what should we spend our money on? Or whatever else it may be. You have to first decide that, well, maybe let's go to Florida, or maybe let's go and let's put this money in our kids' college fund. But before you can decide on what you're going to do when you get to Florida or where they should go to, you know, college, you've got to make a decision that we're going to debate this particular issue now. And that's what is called the motion to proceed. And the Senate has to decide what it's going to debate. And it makes sense to me. But once you get on that motion, that can be filibustered. The Senate then, to end debate, files cloture. And cloture, under its rules, requires 60 votes typically. Now, what I find fascinating is that the Senate doesn't have to use cloture. And prior to 1917, the Senate didn't even have cloture, and it still was able to do a lot of really big stuff. And so the question is, how can the Senate work without cloture? And it's quite simple. You have plenty of other rules. And these are things that are, they left out. You know, Vice President Harris accuses the Republicans of exploiting arcane rules to prevent a debate on this bill. Biden says the Republicans are basically vetoing this bill. Well, there are no vetoes in the Senate. And what Harris leaves out is that those arcane rules also allow Democrats to begin debate on this bill if they want, and they choose not to. And I'm flabbergasted. It seems to me the only reason Democrats may not want to begin debate on a voting rights bill that they say is absolutely critical to safeguard our democracy and blame Republicans for stopping them is because they think that will play well in elections. Or maybe, if I'm cynical, they don't really care all that much, right? But why on earth would it be that a senator would say, let's go the route of 60 votes when there are other rules on the books that allow us to do this in a perfectly lawful way with a simple majority? And the only answer I can come up with in addition to those is that they don't want to put in the hard work, what Biden called the hard work of democracy yesterday. Like they just don't want to do it. They don't want to sit on the floor and actually wait and force senators to talk.
And so as you are watching this drama play out, there seems to be a growing sense that Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer don't have the votes to destroy the filibuster and thereby further mutate the Senate, that these voting rights or election integrity bills are not going, in fact, to get taken up. How important would you say, as a serious student, as well as a longtime practitioner of the business of the legislative process, it is that those steps be foregone, if I can use that expression, that we not see this ultimate legacy, perhaps, of Harry Reid come to fruition?
Well, going back to Harry Reid, something he did quite effectively, and people forget this, before the Senate first kind of nuked its filibuster recently in 2013, was that he used the threat of eliminating the filibuster quite effectively to compel and coerce and persuade Republican senators to ultimately reverse their positions rather publicly and actually, you know, take an about face and vote for nominees and bills that they previously pledged and not to support and actually voted against. And he did it quite effectively for several months heading into November of 2013 when Democrats eliminated the filibuster. And I think that's part of what Schumer's doing now, and part of the reason why he may be willing to threaten this action, even though he may not necessarily have the votes. And also, by setting it up in this way, he can isolate senators. So Senator Manchin, for instance, is one of the problems that he has, that he doesn't have his vote. Well, Manchin is also on the outs with his party on the Build Back Better Act. I think his party is very frustrated with him in several ways. His constituents may not be, but his party is. And so individuals, people, and human beings don't like to be isolated from their colleagues. And now Schumer set up a situation where Manchin's going to be one of the very few people that are opposing his party on this issue as well. And so by setting up the situation, and this is something Reid did very effectively, Schumer is basically pressuring both Republicans and Manchin to go along with him, all to avoid this threat of what he's going to do. But if they do that, if they go along with him, they've actually rendered the filibuster rather meaningless at that point.
Yeah. You mentioned that they'd gotten rid of the filibuster before. I think that's what they were calling a carve-out, as I recall, was it not, for certain purposes? And how does that work? That's sort of what some people are suggesting they should do in this case as well, with the election issue.
The Constitution empowers a majority of the Senate to determine how it wants to conduct its proceeding. There's no doubt about that. The question is whether the Senate ought to break its rules or ignore its rules or otherwise circumvent its rules without complying with those rules. And that's where I think that's where I draw the line as a parent. Anybody who has young kids or can remember when they had young kids, you can't start making exceptions to the rules. The rule is either the rule or it's not the rule. And if you don't like the rule, then you should change the rule. And most recently, Republicans and Democrats, for that matter, created a carve-out for the debt limit increase and for debt limit legislation. This was just last month. They've done it for Supreme Court nominees. They've done it for regular presidential nominees to the judiciary, for executive branch nominees. And every time you ignore the rules, and if your listeners go to the Senate rule book, the rule still says it takes 60 votes to end debate on a Supreme Court nominee. It's right there. It's written down. I thought we were a country of the rule of law. And that's a Senate rule. And the Senate hasn't even bothered to rewrite it. I mean, think about that for a second. The Senate hasn't even bothered to rewrite its rules. It just ignores them. That's the kind of place that we have spent hundreds of years, trying to defend freedom and democracy from. But here we are. It's like, well, in the name of it, we're going to
get rule of law.
This rule of law thing is quaint. I say this is important, and we're just going to ignore it. Well, where does that end?
I'm with you on its importance, and that it should end right here rather than continuing further down this very, very troubling path. Let me ask you quickly, and we've only got 2 minutes left, James, but I did want to ask you about your thoughts more generally about Joe Biden's speech in Georgia yesterday, and in particular his vow to defeat domestic enemies, as he put it.
I find this very concerning. Look, I worked in the Capitol. I met my wife there. I went to meetings with you there. It is a very special and sacred place to me. And I was horrified by watching people vandalize it on January 6th. I just want to come out and say it. But there is a difference, and those people are being prosecuted by the law, but there is a difference between what is happening in state legislatures around the country. There is a difference between senators exercising their rights under the Senate rules and the Constitution to adjudicate the concerns of their constituents and a lawless act. And what Biden has done, what Democrats have done, is they've equated those two things. Biden says that, and I find it very ironic, that Biden talks about how sacred it is that a simple majority be able to decide whatever it wants, even if the rules say otherwise, and talks about safeguarding our democracy under the Constitution, and then turns around and demonizes state legislatures that are empowered under the Constitution to regulate our elections. And they're doing it with a simple majority vote. Isn't that interesting? And so at that point, it's like, well, which one is it? And then you begin to think, well, maybe it has nothing to do with the Constitution. And maybe it has nothing to do with safeguarding our democracy. And maybe it has everything to do with rhetoric designed to delegitimize our opponents so that we can win this debate without actually engaging in Biden's words, hard work of democracy to win that debate, to persuade our fellow Americans that our way is the best way.
And perhaps even worse, not just to delegitimate, but to actually take action against in ways that would punish or perhaps incarcerate people who happen to be afoul of that that rule. It's just extremely troubling,
and I grew up in the South. I'm a Southerner, but when you compare someone, be they from the South or anywhere else, in the Senate who votes against cloture on a motion to proceed, which Biden did plenty of times, to George Wallace and Bull Connor and Jefferson Davis. I mean, come on. That is not a serious statement. You can disagree with their opposition to the voting rights bill, but this is not the same thing. And anybody who thinks a senator voting against the motion to proceed on debate is the same thing as turning fire hoses on American citizens, children and women and men who are out trying to win the rights that everybody else has, that is just absolutely absurd. And that tells me that he is not interested in actually having the debate that he was calling on the Senate to have.
He doesn't want a debate that has an outcome that he doesn't want, that's for sure. And that hopefully is where this is headed. James Wolner, thank you so much for this short course on civics and the United States Senate and the important role that it plays and must continue to play with due respect, as you say, for the rights of the minority. God bless you, my friend. We'll look forward to visiting often, I hope, in 2022. And thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, we will be speaking with somebody else right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is Stephen Bryan. Dr. Bryan is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, and we're very proud of that fact. He is also a man of great accomplishment, both in government and in the private sector. He has run major defense contractors. He has been a deputy undersecretary of the Defense Department, responsible for technology policy back in the Reagan administration when, let me hasten to add, men were men. We had a chance to work together during that period. He's a good friend and always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Dr. Bryan, thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, we're in a world of hurt, Steve, I think is the way to describe the general topic. I'd like to start with China, which you have been doing some very important writing about and admonitions concerning. And I'd like to get your reading on the extent to which what seems now in the off.
Well, I think right now China is in the middle of a major military buildup, and it's threatening Taiwan, of course, and it's flying aircraft around Taiwan and ships in the Taiwan Strait and doing anything they can to intimidate the Taiwanese. And they're also threatening the southern Senkaku Islands, which belong to Japan, and in effect threatening Japan, claiming that they have ownership of those islands, which are under Japanese administration since more or less the end of World War II. So it's getting to be a dicey situation because these sorts of threats could materialize into an incident which can turn into a major conflict. I think that's the scenario we see right now. I don't know that the Chinese would necessarily attack Taiwan today or tomorrow morning or 3 months from now. Nobody knows, but they're certainly acting as if they would. The U.S., of course, has forces in Japan and on Okinawa and back in Guam, but that's pretty far back. It's over 1,000 miles away. But we haven't done a whole lot up to now to really concentrate our efforts to make the Chinese understand that we will respond if they attack. I mean, this is a major, major problem for the United States, as it is for Japan and as it is for the other allies and friends in the region, including, of course, Taiwan.
You've written about the importance of the U.S.-Japanese partnership in influencing Chinese thinking about the advisability or at least the likelihood they can engage in hostility against Taiwan with impunity or at an acceptable cost, let me put it that way. Give us a flavor of both what the Biden team has been doing of late with Japan and what we need to do beyond that to try to actually ensure that the Chinese are getting the message loud and clear.
Well, last week there was what we call a 2+2 meeting. That is the foreign minister and defense minister of Japan and the secretary of state and the secretary of defense of the United States held a one-day meeting. It was on Friday of last week. And it was an important meeting, and there was a lot of progress, I think, made at that meeting. I was very encouraged, actually, that basically we pledged much more coordination with Japan militarily. We also said we would help Japan reinforce the southern Senkaku Islands where the Chinese are threatening. We raised serious concerns about Taiwan, with both Japan and the United States, who were united on that point very clearly and strongly, encouraged only peaceful negotiations, nothing else. So it was a positive meeting, I think, a very good one. But there's still missing pieces. The biggest single missing piece is a common operating arrangement between Japan and the United States militarily, so that if something really does happen, we're fully coordinated, we're fully prepared to take it on, and we can work with Japanese, which is all important because we have to be close to the threat. We have to be able to operate our aircraft. We need logistics. We need support. We need supplies. All that depends on Japan much more than anything else. And so this kind of arrangement is very important. I think we're moving in that direction. I would prefer we moved even faster.
You talk about a common operating arrangement. You've also written, Steve, at Asia Times about the need for an Asian command structure that is up to the task here.
Well, that's what a common operating
system is. Just walk us through what that would look like.
It would be a command.
Okay. Talk a little bit about what is involved in that and why we don't have such a apparatus in place right now.
I think the U.S. approach has always been that if there's a problem in the area, we would take care of it ourselves without anybody else, which is very unrealistic, but that's sort of a neo-colonialist Pentagon attitude. But the truth of the matter is that we can't. I mean, we have to use bases on Japanese territory. We have to have the support of the Japanese civilian and military authorities at the bare minimum. And we should be able to use Japanese assets like their radars, their air defense systems such as they are, all that we need to be able to take advantage of. We need their fuel supplies. We need everything to support any effort that we might make. And we shouldn't make it by ourselves. We should ask them to join us. And I think that's the import of the meeting with the 2+2 that, I think it's better understood now. One of the outcomes of the 2+2, which I think was quite encouraging, is the southern Senkaku Islands, especially one called Yonaguni, which is the southernmost one. It's about 67 miles from Taiwan. And I know that the U.S. Marines and through PACOM have asked the Japanese in a positive way to be able to put some systems, some missile systems on that island that can reach Taiwan and, in effect, stop any invasion by using those missiles. That would be a big step up, and I think that's going to happen.
There are others besides the Japanese who, of course, are potentially critical to position vis-a-vis the Chinese in the Indo-Pacific region. Could you just talk about how that command structure might sort of build on the so-called quad arrangements of India and Australia, as well as the Japanese, and whether indeed such a structure needs to be looking at others beyond, including the Philippines, perhaps?
True. I mean, the first point is, where do we have defense agreements? We have Korea, we have Japan, we have Australia. Those are defense, we have mutual defense agreements with those countries. Don't have that with India, not at all. Certainly not with the Philippines, although we have some arrangements with the Philippines, but those are always very sketchy, in my opinion. So, and Singapore, we have some arrangements with Singapore, but again, it's not a defense treaty or agreement. So that doesn't mean we can't move ahead on some kind of joint system that takes into account not just political, but also military coordination. And, it's what we've done with NATO, in effect. We don't have defense treaties with every NATO country, but we have NATO. So NATO is a collective security alliance arrangement. And I think we need that out in the Pacific. We need a collective security. So someone attacks you, we'll come to your aid. And everyone else will come to your aid that's in the pact. And that's how NATO works. We should have that in the Pacific. We don't have it today.
But that's different than the command arrangement talking about.
No, but if you look at NATO,
is a
NATO
specific warfighting capability.
NATO has a command arrangement. That's what they do at SHAPE headquarters in Brussels. That's part of the deal.
That's the collective defense piece of this.
So you could have that in the Pacific. And then the common command structure would be part of it, just like it is in NATO.
Would be built in. Yeah. We're a ways from having that. The question is, should we have our minds concentrated by what the Chinese are doing at the moment and may do in the not too distant
Absolutely.
Future?
Absolutely. I mean, you're right on that point. I mean, I think that it's clear enough now that if we just sit on our hands, we're going to lose.
Steve, let me switch gears because I want to take advantage of your time, both in government and in the defense industry, to ask you about what's going on at the moment in these, they're called negotiations between the United States and the Russians. They're to be expanded to NATO this week, and I guess ultimately to pull in the most interested party of all, the Ukrainians and the rest of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe later in the week. Are we, in fact, essentially negotiating the surrender of Ukraine, would you say, to the Russians, however it's dressed up?
I don't think so, although it could look that way. This is very tricky waters. you know, because the Russians are really threatening. They put thousands of troops around the Ukraine. They could attack at any moment if they want to. So, and they're making demands, but the demands seem to me, there are two demands that I understand, two types of demands. One type of demand is about NATO, its presence in, or potential presence in Ukraine, but also the NATO dispositions in Eastern Europe. And the Russians have raised those issues and demanded some kind of security guarantees from the United States and from NATO, which are unlikely to get, but that's what they've raised. So that's one set of issues. The other set of issues is what's going on in Ukraine. And this mostly today is focused on the Eastern Ukraine, the Donbass region, which has a large pro-Russian and Russian population. And there, that's governed mostly by the Minsk agreements, and there are two of them, but the second Minsk agreement, and like the first one actually too, says that this should be negotiated, and what they should negotiate is making those regions autonomous, but still under Ukrainian law, which means that the Donbass area could send representatives to the Ukrainian parliament, but it would govern itself. Now, that's broadly what it says. What it really, what the details are missing, completely missing. But and that was a process that was supposed to be negotiated at Minsk, where the OSCE, the Europeans, and the United States and Russia would get together with the Ukrainians to nail this thing down and come up with a solution. That sort of drifted off the table to some extent in these conversations, as far as we understand them, because there's no protocols from the meetings that took place so far, although it sounds like they mostly talked about NATO. And I think that's where the solution lies, if there's a solution. And by the way, that's also what Putin has said. I mean, he said, you know, Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, should come to Minsk and we should negotiate this, blah, blah. So, I mean, the Russians are not against it by any means. And they have a lot to gain if I don't see what benefit, how this benefits Moscow to get into a war over the Ukraine. I mean, it seems to me crazy. But you know, here it is.
Well, the question is, I guess, can they extract concessions, strategic concessions, with the threat of war, without actually having to get embroiled in one? And the intention of the Biden team, as the president repeatedly put it, to accommodate Putin, makes me think that that may well be the upshot of all of this.
Frank, I'm not
and
sure.
It's, what's just a little bit nervous making is the fact that, as we've seen in the past, emboldening bad actors, especially with the allies or friendly partners, if not actually technically allies, not at the table, has got a pretty bad track record. You can think of it as the Czechoslovakian Republic thrown under the bus by Neville Chamberlain. You can think of, for that matter, the Afghans thrown under the bus by successive U.S. administrations. Not at the table.
That's correct. Well, they'll be at the table indirectly in the NATO meeting.
Well, they won't be at the table, I don't think, until the OSCE meeting. But anyway, the point is that the conversations that have taken place to this point sound to me to have been done principally between the
that's
Russians
right.
and the United States.
That. Yeah, that's true.
If I were the Ukrainians, I would not be terribly trusting of the tender mercies of this administration.
Well, we'll ask the Afghans that question. They'll tell
indeed.
You the answer.
That's part of why I think they would be suspicious.
I mean, right now,
indeed. We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, Steve. Can I ask you just very quickly, any thoughts on the ongoing drama in Kazakhstan at the moment? The Russians have put troops in on the ground to quell a domestic uprising against I guess, the corrupt and increasingly autocratic government there. Any thoughts as to where this leads? The Chinese are expressing interest in it.
Well, I mean, the Russians, want to control the stands as much as they can. And Kazakhstan's quite important because it's got lots of minerals, especially uranium. And it's a place where the Russians do their space launches, commercial ones anyway. So it's an important place for them. Putin says today that he's going to pull the troops out in a couple of days. So let's see if that happens. But it's their territory. It's their air. It's their backyard. So I don't think we can say a whole lot. I mean,
sphere of influence.
Yeah, you can say use that old term.
But that's what they say about Ukraine too.
Both of them. Yeah. basically in the Russians' backyard. They used to be part of Russia, weren't they? Both of them.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, there were a lot of other places that the Russians think are in their backyard too, and that we've increasingly thought of as free and sovereign states. And I guess the question is, are they going to redefine those?
No, that's sort of the game that's being played.
Perhaps yeah. Beyond the stance or Ukraine. Yeah, it is. Steve, I know you'll be following this closely. We'll be watching your writings on these subjects and look forward to a further visit with you about them all, especially the China piece in the very near future.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate
Thank you
that.
For your time today, sir.
Bye-bye.
God bless you. Your service to our country. Keep it up. Talk to you soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and as is always a distinct privilege to say, we are joined by Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, former special operator with a background in psychological warfare operations, among other things. Also a man who has served as a civilian in senior ranks of the Office of the Secretary of Defense, specializing, among other things, in cyber warfare. He's a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, a great friend and an invaluable resource for all of us. And we're always delighted to have him featured prominently here at Secure Freedom Radio. John, welcome back, I think for the first time in the new year. So a happy one to you.
Oh, thank you, Frank. As always, an honor to be with you. Thank you so much.
Let me ask you first, John, about a problem that I know you have been thinking a lot about, both in the tech space and more generally, notably as part of our work at the Committee on the Present Danger China, trying to raise awareness about the magnitude of the threat we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party. And that is the help that American companies are giving to the CCP in making that threat all the more intense. You write for the Epoch Times frequently. There is an article about American companies in the tech sector supercharging military as well as dual use activities of the Chinese communists. Give us a quick assessment as a military man and a cyber warfare specialist and all the rest of your credentials. What is up with this? And what are the implications of it, John?
Well, this has been a major theater of conflict in advance of potential real conflict with China, is interdicting and addressing U.S. companies enabling the buildup and the capabilities and capacities of communist China and their armed forces, their intelligence. And this is just, it has been an ongoing battle for a number of years. It really started happening with the anger, and I personally witnessed this, the anger inside the Obama administration as they were upset that China was stealing through the Office of Personnel Management breach and wanted to get tough with them by naming people. It's continued on since then. Of course, the best at this has been President Trump and Dr. Peter Navarro aggressively using our entities list and a financial interdiction to block these activities. The Biden administration has come out with a new list just a few weeks ago, where DJI and others were named. But we still they play the seam lines and they play the gaps by renaming companies, finding areas where they're not on Department of Commerce's entity list. And we still got some of the big names: Dell, Google, Hewlett Packard, IBM. Intel, Microsoft. We just have to interdict this, and because they're playing the gaps and seams where the federal government is either incompetent, unaware, and that unaware aspect is huge. Don't ever underestimate the unaware aspect. And
there's another possible explanation, John, which I think we at least ought to take note of, and that is complicit. That is to say, absolutely. Actually supporting this kind of collaboration with the Chinese in various domains. John, you touched on the financial aspect of this. One of the places where, of course, we've spent a lot of time, very much with the inspiration and leadership of our colleague Roger Robinson, on this question of the capital markets and the extent to which we're not just providing technology or otherwise supercharging the Chinese mastery of the various means of competing militarily as well as in the civilian sense, but we're actually underwriting the threat itself in a whole host of ways. The question recurs, John Mills. You're, again, a serious national security guy. What is it that these companies, whether it's in the financial sector or the tech sector or otherwise, seem not to get about the national security dangers associated with enriching, to say nothing of empowering and emboldening, the Chinese Communist Party?
Yeah, it's very simple. Larry Fink at BlackRock, essentially the largest investment firm in the world, his quarterly and annual payout is taking precedence over the American people and free people of the world. They're far more interested in quarterly returns, so they're willing to, they're essentially willing to sell their soul and the country and everyone for those quarterly returns that essentially form the base of the their payouts. I'm sorry, it's really no more complicated than that.
Greed, I think, is the short form of this. Is that right?
Absolutely.
The irony of it is, and you mentioned Larry Fink, who happens to be a bete noir of ours, as you know so well. He's just perhaps the most egregious example of this phenomenon. But it's not, it seems, John, that it's so much the payout to his clients that's operating here as much as it is the money that he personally may be getting and commissions and fees and the like. Ray Dalio and Vanguard's CEOs and so on. I mean, this is a particularly parochial view that doesn't even extend to the people he's supposedly, working for.
Yeah, let's just simplify it. His God is his quarterly and annual payout, and he places that, gives that precedence over America and the American people. It's as simple as that. So we need to personalize it. He is focused on his quarterly and annual payouts. That's what it's all about.
That personal payout is what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. John, it's shocking, not entirely surprising given where we are at the moment, but nonetheless something that needs to be corrected, as does more generally, it seems to me, the question of whether or not this kind of behavior, and it's just one example of it, but this kind of attitude towards the Chinese is something that we can survive for any length of time. I'm thinking in particular of the need for a war footing more generally in our country. And that starts with recognizing the danger of the enemy and also trying to be defending ourselves against it in every respect. And again, you've given a lot of thought to the military implications of the Chinese threat and what we need to be doing about it. But how important is it to be mobilizing the home front and, our industrial sector as well as, the defense industrial base, most obviously, to meet this challenge?
Yeah, we need to go back to almost World War II level of strategic thinking to understand all these our industrial output, our capabilities, because these will all be important. God forbid we proceed to a kinetic engagement. I think China is being pressured, forced. I just saw an article this morning. Xi's number one job is to eliminate the threat from internal elements, meaning people who are potentially going to overthrow him. That's actually his number one priority right now. But I think there's a window right after the Olympics, grave concerns. Our industrial base, we need to start talking about aircraft factories, shipyards, our ability to ramp up our nuclear production as a deterrence and especially small nukes, because those are have immense deterrence value. The reality that we are willing to deploy nukes with small warheads, and you know, the shipbuilding capacity is one of the most, and the Navy, which is really the vanguard of our ability to deter and, if necessary, defeat the Chinese PLA and Navy. Once they get past their CRT training, they need to focus on basic seamanship to make sure their ships are not bumping into each other. And a lot of this is about the ability to rapidly repair, regenerate ships that have been damaged back into line the line of duty. And that means forward capabilities in Guam. I mean, it means floating dry docks that there we have a handful. They need to be moved forward so we can rapidly maintain and repair ships and get them right back into action. Those are very wise preparatory activities that also demonstrate resolve and deterrence and will hopefully make China think twice.
John, a number of the things that you just talked about there are very long lead items. You know, Don Rumsfeld famously said, you go to war with the Army, and I guess for that matter, the Navy, you have. And if you don't have those shipbuilding facilities or those aircraft production lines or those dry docks, for that matter, not only ready to go, but where you need them and in a position to be actually ramped up, you're going to find they're not much use in the kind of kinetic prospect that you're, I think, wisely warning of. Talk a little bit about why it may be as early as March that we might see things pop with, well, the Chinese communists perhaps in Taiwan or India or both, or Ukraine for the Russians, maybe other neighboring states, or Iran and Israel. I mean, these are the sorts of places that we anticipate and are working to try to flesh out as prospects for a conflict in our countdown to conflict project. I'd be very interested in your thoughts about, you know, the very short term and most especially what you can do to deter in that window.
Well, I think of all, there's a lot of moving parts and they all point toward a likelihood of conflict. I mentioned the article this morning where Xi is on a rampage to eliminate the internal threat to his hold of power. That's a huge, just the mere fact that that came out was a huge indicator of the duress, but also they're under food duress, they're under energy duress. Dictators, when they're under duress, like the financial duress, they think and project outwardly. They're not going to interrupt the Olympics. A good totalitarian never interrupts an Olympic opportunity. So they're going to let the genocide games as much as they can. We have supposedly a diplomat that we will not have diplomats travel, but that seems to even have eroded a bit. But after the genocide Olympics is a danger, just like after the Sochi Olympics. Within days, Putin put his game, start executing his game plan for encroaching upon the Donbass in the Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula. So I foresee we need to be on red alert, no pun intended, now to demonstrate deterrence. And I think likelihood of an accelerated artillery duel, because the reality is this, the Russians do not have that much force structure, even as reinforced. Much of it will be kind of optics and strategic communication, but there also will be encroachment potentially on the Indian border. I also read another article here where China is autonomous capabilities, ground vehicles along the border. I think one of there was a border clash I think it was in 2020, where the Chinese did not end up well, and it created a catastrophe of public relations internally because of the loss of life on the Chinese side and the shoddy way in which those families who lost sons were treated. But so Ukraine, Indian border, I would say putting myself as a PLA, the Army or the Navy planner with the high staff in Beijing, why invade Taiwan when you can bypass Taiwan and envelop it? So I'm concerned about encroachment onto the northern Philippines. There's a huge opportunity to secure that access to the deep ocean by securing the right shoulder, which is the Philippines, the left shoulder being Taiwan. But if you secure that left, that right shoulder of the Philippines, if you hug the Filipino coast and go down to just below New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, remember World War II history, the Solomon Islands are in chaos right now. Their China-leaning prime minister is under duress because the population is pro-Taiwan, not pro-China, and he's asked for police trainers. The translation of that's a code word for soft invasion opportunity.
For the Chinese. They seem to be taking advantage of it, don't they? John, all of this is really a very important background for the kind of activity that needs to be taken, not only to stop doing things that are counterproductive and dangerous, indeed, but take steps that might actually prevent conflict while there's still time. And another thing you touched on that I just wanted to ask your thoughts on quickly are these genocide games. The Chinese Communist Party, obviously, as you've indicated, sees an opportunity, as Adolf Hitler did, for example, back in 1936, to capitalize on the seeming endorsement and legitimization of the international by having its athletes in Beijing in February for these Winter Games. As you know, John, one of our projects at the Committee on the Present Danger of China with Reggie Littlejohn's outfit, the Women's Rights Without Frontiers, has been to argue that we should not be participating in these games. It's become increasingly compelling, I think, as an argument in light of the real threats to the physical well-being, maybe even the lives of our athletes.
John Mills, we have to leave it at that. Thanks for these insights into the magnitude of the danger we're facing at the moment and what might happen even the next few months, and the dangers particularly of having... Thanks to all of you for listening as well. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, while ostensibly promoting voting rights, Joe Biden declared war on people he explicitly described as domestic enemies. He was not talking about the Marxists and Islamists, who have made no secret of their desire to fundamentally transform America, replacing via stolen elections or through color revolutions our constitutional republic with the form of totalitarian government they respectively favor. Such actual enemies are, of course, part of Biden's base. Instead, he's targeting Americans who share a love of God and the freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution, a commitment to election integrity, and a reluctance to be vaccinated with increasingly ineffective and even harmful so-called vaccines. It's not treason to oppose Mr. Biden's desperate bid to enact legislation that would impose permanently and nationwide the fraud-conducive voting arrangements that enabled his election. And Americans who do so are not the enemy. This is Frank Gaffney.